Oh yes, definitely. I still have the amplifier. It was my first high-powered amplifier, and with 3,500 volts on that. That's from that power supply. The tubes, believe it or not, I hate to tell you, but they went to 2,000 watts. I used to tune it up, and you'd watch the inside, like you say, those carbon elements. I watched that carbon element in there start to glow red. And when it glowed red, I said, aha, now it's really putting out what it's supposed to. And it did. It would run easily 2,000 watts of power. So it's like you say, one heck of a tube, and they used them. And then later on, they did produce one more amplifier, which they changed over to. Basically, it was towards the end of the company's reign of, where they were just, a lot of American companies started to fall by the wayside. They went to another staunchy surplus tube called the 4-400 stick over.
And these, when it comes to kilowatt type amplifiers that are really rugged, they can tolerate an open circuit, a short circuit, or whatever at the antenna for ridiculous lengths of time. You can abuse the daylights out of them. Properly used, those tubes are extremely rugged. Yes, you've got to wait for the filament to heat up when you first turn it on, although some of them have rapid heating filaments. You also have to worry about proper cooling. They're a little bit more bulky. A solid-state amplifier looks more exotic, and it's smaller in size, and in some cases a little bit more efficient. But the components that will give you kilowatt level tend to be very expensive, and they tend to be very vulnerable. If you don't have enough protection circuits built in, a momentary short circuit or open circuit at the antenna could damage your final stage. In fact, your no-tube amplifiers, no-tune amplifiers, your transceivers that you buy these days, the reason why they've got a self-protect circuit in there that beyond approximately a 1.5 standing wave ratio at the antenna input connector, at the antenna output connector, if it sees any more than that, they go into a self-protect mode to start cutting themselves back to make sure the final stage of transistorized amplification does not become damaged. So that's the reason for that. That's the vulnerability. Pays you money, it takes your choice. And there's a lot of places where there's lots of places where the, I was going to say, stand by a minute. Somebody needed some help on one of the remote controls in the house. At the kilowatt level, tubes have still got an awful lot to go for. When it comes to, say for instance, a 10 gigacycle ham radio, 10 gig ham band, 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz, 10,000 to 10,500. Solid state can easily get you up to approximately 10 watts. Beyond that, you're probably forced into using a traveling wave tube. There are traveling wave tubes that will put out 1,000 watts, and they've got 35 decibels of gain. You want anything beyond the 50-watt level, 30-watt level, at the 10-gig ham band, you're going to be using a fermionic emission device, a vacuum device to do it, if you want to do it with reliability and high gain. So you may think that you're a modern ham radio operator, modern electronic engineer, where everything should be transistorized, everything should be solid state. There are still very many places where vacuum devices, tubes, are very, very appropriate. I worked for the 35-year period of time in electronic countermeasures, high power transmitters for both the B-1B bomber and the EA-6B standoff jammer. And their tubes really shine. You want high reliability, a lot of power output, a lot of bandwidth, you're going to use a tube. You try to make a solid state equivalent, and many companies tried and failed. Very, very difficult to make reliable, high power, broadband, solid state equipment at UHF and SH frequencies. EHF frequency, essentially out of the question. It's beyond the state of the art at this time. Go to your next one if you want to, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the DECnet.
Okay. Very good. This is K2KY. Yeah. Yeah, they were, as you say, quite a difference in what you are looking at today in modern equipment. But still, the final word is if you have one of those amplifiers, you can get a hold of one of those amplifiers. Good grief. You're going to have something that's, yeah, heavyweight, but I'll tell you, you got to go a far way to try to destroy one of them, and nothing like you have today. That's basically, don't let anyone tell you that it's an obsolete piece of equipment as far as using that old-fashioned linear amplifier. See, a lot of people shy away from it. All right, I'm just looking for something else. Okay, on coax cable. I obtained a lot of coax cable that was being actually L8U RG8U, and it's about 30 years old. I took the length I need, I put a dummy load on it, and it measured at the end, at the shack end. You put the dummy load on the end where the antenna is going to go, and at the shack end, I measure 1-to-1 SWR. Do you think that this cable is still usable? Because my friends tell me that it's most likely dried out, and as soon as it's going to hook it up, you're going to be wasting your time. You know, that's a good question. When they really do you say, you know, the cable is no longer usable, Dick, over?
I say there is no hard and fast rule in that one, Bill, and you're going to tell me your experience in this one also. If the cable was of a poor design, which has so-called contaminating materials, in other words, if the rubber outer coating is made from a material which leaches polyvinyl chloride or some other substance, which then migrates through the outer shield into the polyethylene dielectric and contaminates it. So if you've got a poor brand to start off with, and if it was stored in the damp corner of a basement where it's been sucking up water and getting contaminated, you'll find out real fast when with your bird watt meter or whatever, you measure how much power you put into the input end. Then you move the bird watt meter down range where the dummy load is, and you find out how much power comes out of the other end. The curves in the good books will tell you how many decibels per 100 feet the cable should be giving you. If your particular piece of RG8U, you discover that it's supposed to give you 3 dB per 100 feet at 200 megacycles, we'll say, and you're doing the test at 200 megacycles because that's where your signal generator is, and you find out it doesn't have 3 dB of loss, it's got 6 dB of loss. 3 dB of loss, which means you put 1 watt in, you get half a watt out, 2-to-1 ratio. Or a 6 dB of loss would be a 4-to-1 ratio. Put in 4 watts, and you only get 1 watt out the other end. So by measuring the power you put in, and then moving the directional watt meter, bird watt meter, or whatever, your instrumentation, down range, you measure how much power you get out of the other end, you'll know the insertion loss of the cable right away. Measuring the input standing wave ratio is a necessary but not sufficient. A lossy piece of contaminated cable might measure good on the standing wave ratio, but might measure terrible on total insertion loss. I recommend you do both. And there's a quick and dirty, let me drop. Once you've got a good dummy load at the far end, and you measure the input end and you get a good standing wave ratio, then you have the ability, if you want to simply create a short circuit or an open circuit at the far end and re-measure the standing wave ratio. And standing wave ratio, once you go through the mathematics, is really reflected power ratio. If your cable, you believe, for your length, has 3 dB of loss, that means the signal goes down, and 3 dB of loss means half the power arrives at the far end. If the far end is a perfect short circuit or open circuit, every bit of that power is going to be reflected. When it gets reflected back toward the shack, another 3 dB of loss happens. Therefore, the round trip would be 6 dB of loss. 6 dB of loss is a particular standing wave ratio. I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's close to 3-to-1. So if you go from a 1-to-1 VSWR with a perfect termination at the far end, and you get a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio when you have an open circuit at the far end, that's a way of doing a round trip measurement. What is the insertion loss of the total length of cable? So the careful, though, that you don't make the prejudgment of good input visual with a dummy load and say, aha, it's a good piece of cable. You've only done half the testing when you do that. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. Other than seeing, like you say, cutting, you know, open and to put a connector on and looking at the braid, if the braid has that green look, you know, that is that contaminated look, I'd say the cable, it's been soaked in water, it's gotten into this jacket there, and forget about it, that it's, well, first of all, usually it shows deterioration at that point. The braid becomes, if you'll notice, actually it becomes almost like a powder. You can almost shake it off thick when you see that effect, that green, I guess it's a, what is it, a contamination from the material of the jacket, or is it because of moisture, which is the most offending situation in that case, that in fact, like I say, the gets to a point where you can actually just about shake the braid off over.
A brand X cable that's very old and mistreated can definitely do that. You take a small portion of it and you slice it open and look inside. That outer braid will have that green tarnish to it. And is that copper oxide? Copper oxide does turn greenish, but I think it's a mixture of the chemistry, of the contamination, the water, and it sometimes can eat right through the braid and has very little mechanical strength left. And you just flex it and pull on it, and it starts breaking apart real fast. And it will also demonstrate high insertion loss. Very rarely could you get a piece of cable where it looks, when you cut it open, really ugly, and you make an insertion loss measurement and you think it's good, and then you put it out in the weather where it's going to be flexed by the wind blowing on it, whatever, and maybe it's going to make multiple break points along its length on that outer braid. Rarely does that happen. Almost always, when a cable has been misused like that, it will show up as excess insertion loss, and you can then make a judgment, is it worth using or should you discard it and start off with fresh cable. I know we amateurs, as we first began, there are lots of ways we could get inexpensive pieces of RG8 and RG58 cable, and should we use that? Your transmitter is not going to blow up, it's not going to catch on fire if you use a really yucky piece of cable to start off with as your first antenna, and at a later time you replace it. I mean, the cable you put up for the antenna doesn't have to be something you're going to put there for the next 10 years, and it's got to be perfect on year number one. So don't be afraid to use it if you've got nothing else. But at a later time, you know, you get some performance improvement when you put in a better piece of cable. Now back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, good answer. That's like I say. I think it could most likely be safely, your stick says nothing's going to blow up, but it could safely be used if that's what you have right now and you're making a basic measurement and seeing that it's, you know, it's displaying on your handheld antenna analyzer with a dummy load on one end and then the other end of the shack, and it's showing that it seems to be okay. I think you can take a chance. Don't be afraid. Don't listen to the people that tell you, oh, what will happen? Good night. You know, you always hear that. They used to come up with such things. Everything was going to be a major catastrophe. It just doesn't happen that way. Shall we grab one more? This is a funny one here. Yeah, you want to try one more thing?
Let's try to catch up. Go for it.
Okay. I'm fairly new to this amateur radio and all this stuff. And I read and I get confused. That sounds like a usual comment. What is the precise ratio of frequency in hertz to actually bandwidth in meters? In other words, what does one hertz actually equal in meters? Ah, you know something? I have an idea, but what is it? What would you say is the precise, if we read it out to a number of decimal points, check over?
I'm going to give it as two answers, two separate answers. One answer, 99.9% of the time is good enough, and it's easy to measure, easy to remember. a radio wave, a light wave, any kind of an electromagnetic wave, photons or whatever, traveling through empty space, and air is very close to empty space, the round-off number is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. 300 meters, 300 million meters per second is the speed of light to the nearest 3 or so decimal places. And 99.9% of the time, good enough. If you take the number and you put it into a handheld calculator, 3 exponential plus 8, or 300 million, put that into your calculator, then you, if it's a reverse Polish calculator, then you put in the frequency in hertz, say for instance 14 megacycles, 14.1 megacycles, 14.1 and enough zeros to make 14.1 million cycles per second, and you hit divide, divide that number into 300 million meters, you'll find out that it is the 20 meter wavelength ham band, the 20 meter band, and 20 meters close enough for most of our purposes, and you can get carry that out to as many decimal places as you want. Let me drop. But now, if you've got a very exacting requirement, and you want to know to greater accuracy, you Google the word speed of light. You go to any good calculator that's got built-in constants to it. It'll tell you what the real speed of light is to eight decimals of accuracy. 2.99792458. I'll repeat that. Most references will tell you the real speed of light is 2.997958 meters times 10 to the 8 meters per second. There was one reference I heard which claimed to be a little bit more accurate, claiming it was 2.997954 instead of 258. 2.997958 is the usual one given. That's going to give you a little bit more accuracy, but you almost don't need it. 3 times 10 to the 8 is good enough 99.9% of the time. Very rarely are you going to be doing some kind of an exacting experiment where you need that number of decimal places of accuracy. But now you can take, let me drop. Now, that formula, 3.0 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, and then you put in the frequency in hertz, gives you wavelength when you do the division. You can do it backwards. If you're operating at the light frequency, the middle of the optical band, 550 nanometers is the wavelength, which is yellow-green in the middle of the performance of your eye. Your eye operates most efficiently at 550 nanometers of wavelength. Back in the old days, everything was measured in wavelength. And you want to know what is the frequency. Do the exact same process. 3 times 10 to the 8, 300 million meters, divided by 550 nanometers. You'd be putting in 550 exponential 9 minus 9. That's a nanometer. Nanometer is meter times 10 to the minus 9 is what a nanometer is. So 550 exponential minus 9, you're putting in the wavelength. Whether you put in frequency or wavelength doesn't matter. You divide either one of those into 300 million meters, and you'll get the opposite. Put in wavelength, you'll get frequency. Put in frequency, you'll get wavelength. And so you're going to ask yourself, what is the wavelength? What is the frequency that my eye operates at? My eye operates at 550 nanometers. That happens to be 10 to the 14 hertz. It's it's roughly 550, I think it's gigahertz? No. That's terahertz, 550 terahertz. Very high frequency that your eye operates at. Your eye is one hell of a piece of equipment. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. So what is actually, let me give the 1 hertz is exactly what is recognized is, if I said 1 hertz, what does that actually mean, or should I say equals, or just write 1 hertz equals what in meters stick over?
If I plugged in that formula I gave you, 1 hertz, and I'm dividing by 1, nothing happens. It is 300 million meters of wavelength. and 300 million meters, let me think now, is 300,000 kilometers, and it's more, I think it's a good fraction of the distance to the moon. I think it's two-thirds of the way to the moon is that distance. That's one wavelength at 1 hertz. I gave you the round-off number. The exact number would be 299792458. Let's see if I got the right number of decimal places there. I know it's going to be roughly 300. You plug in the right number of zeros so that 2.99792458, and you put the right number of zeros so it comes out very close to 300 million meters. That would be the wavelength at 1 hertz. That wavelength, if I was operating at a transmitter at 1 hertz, which you could do, the antenna would be a little bit difficult to generate, the power would be a little bit difficult to generate, but you could make a 1 hertz antenna, and one single wave of that signal you're transmitting would have a length that's between the Earth and two-thirds of the distance to the moon, 300 million meters long. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, I just wanted to confirm that's exactly what I got. 299792458 meters. That's precisely as I have it here also, Dick. And that's very funny that, you know, that question has come up quite often. You know, is it exactly, and I said, not a little under, but rounded off to 300,000. Okay, very good. Let's see, do I have anything else that's interesting like that? Okay. Some of these questions are funny, but I guess I could say that there's some seriousness to it. How, if you get electrical shock and you get thrown, how does electricity throw you? I don't know. I don't know if that's a joke or whatever, Vic, but you want to say something about that? Does electricity throw you? I don't think so, but what happens when you get an electrical shock and you go flying over?
If you took a thoroughly dead animal, a deer, a bear, a dog, a rabbit, or whatever, a thoroughly dead animal, and put electricity across his feet, limbs, head to tail, whatever, if he's thoroughly dead and been dead for a while, nothing happens. Electricity does not propel an animal. The majority of what goes on inside your body, the brain issues an order, the order travels down a nerve, and the nerve gives an order to the muscle, and the muscle contracts, and therefore your leg moves, your arm moves, your fingers move, and so on. And that signal going down the nerve is primarily chemical, but there's a kind of an electronic component to it. At each one of those junctions, and there's zillions of them between your brain and your toe, each one of those little junctions is passing on the signal. A whole lot of relaying is taking place. When I put a relatively high voltage or enough current across the limb of the human being, I break down the insulation on that nerve. I start affecting the chemical reaction that's taking place at each one of those junctions, and now I create a phony signal. So now the muscle thinks it has been given an extremely strong command to contract. Let me drop. You connect the right kind of electronics to the right kind of place on a human being while his heart is beating or while his arm is moving or whatever. You'll find that the brain is sending a kind of a digital signal. It's a raspy sounding click, click, click like signal. And depending on the rate of the clicks, the brain is telling you how hard that muscle should contract. You put a high enough voltage across that nerve, instead of there being individual clicks, it becomes a key down signal. Maximum command, contract that muscle as hard as you possibly can. And if you're in the right kind of position, and the muscle on your foreleg has been told to contract, and you're in a slightly squatting position, for instance, and that muscle contracts as hard as it possibly can, you will jump quite high in the air. So the order the muscle has been given, the phony order the muscle has been given, by way of the current flowing through that nervous system, creates the action that creates what looks like you've been thrown. Your brain may not be able to issue a command that strong to that muscle, but a high enough current flowing through that nervous system can issue that command with that strength. And it can come close to the point of damaging the muscle, damaging the tendon that connects the muscle to the bone. So without a doubt, you get what looks like thrown. The electricity didn't do it directly. It did it indirectly by the action of your muscles being given a phony command. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, sounds like a good answer. So what you basically you're saying, that if a large electrical current goes through your body, your muscles will be, I guess you call it stimulated, to actually what, contract very strongly, so that, in other words, the muscles may be contracted harder than they would be if they were voluntarily. In other words, you may just all of a sudden be much faster than you think that you could be moving under voluntary conditions because of this so-called very high voltage stimulation. Am I correct what you're saying? Over.
Yes, you are. And it depends on where the two contact points are. In order for current to flow through, I mean, you have to place... There's a point of entry for the current and a point of exit for the current. And in the old days, when Mel and I were going to the FCC exam, the threshold of alarm where lethality could take place used to be called 200 milliamperes. If 200 milliamperes is flowing from your left hand to your right hand in the old days, there is a chance that the contraction of your heart due to that electrical current flowing from your left hand to your right hand, if it occurred at the right period of the RST wave of your cardiac operation, could send you into fibrillation, could, without a defibrillator, it could be lethal. 200 milliamps used to be the threshold of alarm. That's not true anymore. I think the threshold of alarm for your GFI circuits, your circuits that automatically interrupt the electrical circuit in your bathroom if they're properly installed, I think they trip at something like 5 or so milliamps, a much smaller number. And depending on what part of the body is getting the current, if you were foolish enough to place a metal electrode on the left-hand temple of your head and the right-hand temple, and you pass current through there, you would be creating electroencephaly, you would be creating electroshock therapy, and you might really create some serious brain damage. You don't want to do that. And only a few milliamps in that case would get you in trouble. So be careful when it comes to anything more than, let me pick a number, 30 volts. If you're operating on anything more than 30 volts, be careful. Make sure that you're only doing it with one hand in your pocket, so to speak, or with a pair of rubber gloves, or using proper safety procedures. Because if some significant number of milliamps, beyond, let's say, 10 milliamps, flows through a particularly critical portion of your body, it could do something that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It could be doing something that is quite unpleasant as far as your muscle contraction, moving your hand, and you end up with a cut hand and bleeding and whatever because it's inside of a piece of equipment, or if that current is flowing through a vital portion of cardiac system, breathing system, brain system, or whatever, it could create some permanent damage, which is something I'm going to discuss as soon as Mel finishes with these questions. I'm going to tell you what has happened recently with these recent measurements concerning cell phones. K2KEY, be careful of high voltage. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I can tell me, lucky I'm alive, tell you the truth. Okay, so you're saying that again, let me make this clear to everybody, that there is a chance that you will have damage to your joints or your or some of the adjacent tissues. In other words, there can be lasting effects from an electrical shock and to try to avoid it. Like I say, I'm not opposed to child, but it's a dick because I surely can tell you that I've had some real bad ones. And I marvel at the fact that it was no after, you know, lasting effect. But I can understand that there is a condition, I guess, that can be the result of an electric shock, supposedly damage to joints, et cetera, like that. So, all right. Well, I guess you sort of covered it pretty well, Dick. Back to you.
For those who've heard the TechNet a whole lot, from time to time you've heard Mel and Dick discuss how lucky we were in our youth. I was operating on a power supply. I was building a power supply at 17 years of age, 16 years of age, and 850 volts was the total winding of the secondary of the transformer with center tap, so it was going to be a 400 and some odd volt power supply for a pair of 807 tubes. And I didn't realize, I was foolish enough to be operating with my hands inside that power supply. I picked up those two wires with 850 volts AC, 60 cycles across them. And I was, I don't know if I was going to connect them to an ohmmeter or what I was, a voltmeter or what I was going to do, but 850 volts appeared between the two fingers, index finger and thumb on my left hand, index finger and thumb on my right hand. And my goodness, did I get a reaction to that. In theory, that could have electrocuted me. I came very close, in my opinion. The reaction was so strong, I let go, I moved so violently, my hand was no longer making contact with that wire, and the condition went away. And that condition probably went away in a few milliseconds. I moved that rapidly, and lucky for me, that particular event did not occur during a particular portion of my cardiac cycle, the RST wave. There's a particular portion of the cardiac cycle where the heart is resting, and if a phony pulse occurs due to an electrical shock during that instant of time, it creates a fibrillation process where the heart now starts beating very rapidly from then on and is no longer pumping blood. And if somebody doesn't get you out of that condition within the next 6 minutes, you're probably going to become brain dead, if not thoroughly dead. So I came close to electrocuting myself. I know that in one of the power supplies that Mel was working on in his youth, in his very naive youth, he came close to electrocuting himself. Maybe you want to say a couple of words of what should...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe you want to say a couple of words of what should be avoided. Over to you, Mel.
Of course, what happened to me that time where I really got belted. Power supply, you know, was complete. I disconnected it to, you know, hook it up and all. And never discharged the filters. Didn't have bleeders. In those days, when I built those power supplies, it was a power supply like you did. Power transformer, a couple of 5U4s, five R4s. I remember using 5R4s because it was also a 750 volt power supply or whatever the heck else. The power also, a pair of 807s or some goddamn setup like that. And I got belted real bad. And the power supply was already, I had a good sense of disconnecting it, but I did never thought of discharging the filter condensers, Dick, over.
So as you can see, we were lucky. I was lucky in a, I had, my first automobile was a Corvair, and the 1963 Corvair, a whole production run, no safety cotter pin was put into the castle nut on the bottom of, the ball joint on the driver's side. And so I had fixed up this automobile, tested it out the night before, put it on a very high-speed highway out east. This is a convertible automobile, and the next morning drove into the parking lot of the company where I was working at, and I was moving about 5 miles an hour, and the front left wheel of the car fell off. Had that occurred the night before at high speed, The wheel falling off would have ridden back into the wheel well, would have flipped the car upside down at very high velocity, and you flipping a car upside down, and it's a convertible, and you ride at high speed down the highway inverted, your chances of surviving are extremely slim. So Mel and I know that we've lived a charmed life. We've come close on a couple of occasions. Thank goodness none of my tower work has ever, I'm a hell of a lot more careful when I'm doing high altitude type work. Okay, so you got to be careful. There's a lot of ways you can die or be maimed. Now, the one other thing I want to mention is that I've been getting lots of letters and phone calls this week because of this report of this cell phone jazz. And I guarantee that the people at Bayville are going to be putting it on their website immediately. As you know, the people in Bayville, Long Island, Nassau County, North Shore, seriously believe that all radio equipment and all transmitting and receiving antennas must be removed from their town. They used to have 3 lawsuits. I know that 2 more were going to be filed in the beginning of February. There could be 5 lawsuits running in parallel right now to remove all the antennas from that town. Let me drop. And as I've said on a number of occasions, we radio operators, we somewhat savvy wireless people who use radio equipment day in and day out, we understand it, we're not afraid of it, and it is not something that is out to kill us immediately unless you do something really ridiculous. So their adversity, their fear of radio is, in my opinion, unjustified and excessive. So by a very slow process, we're going to have to slowly educate the people of that town, among 4 other towns on Long Island. Hempstead Town, for instance, has set some rules where they're trying to literally make it impossible to install cell sites in that town. The nearest, every cell site must be 1,500 feet away from every place of worship, every school, and every place of residence. That restricts every single place in the town of Hempstead. You can't put in any new cell sites. We want the safety, we want the convenience of cell sites, but everyone says, not in my backyard. They have the mistaken impression that every radio dose is an overdose, and that's excessive. The Federal Communications Commission, the American National Standards Institute, the Bureau of Radiological Health in the United Kingdom, all of these major organizations for more than 60 years have been studying the effects of radio and mankind. Let me drop. So it's very well documented, very well measured as to what constitutes a potential hazard of radio frequency emission, RF radiation. The problem is a emotional problem with a vocabulary word, radiation. A signal you put into an antenna spreads out in all directions. Yes, it radiates. Therefore, the process of sending a radio signal is called radiation. And until World War II, that was a beautiful word, until atomic energy came along, and now you had atomic radiation. And the difference between atomic radiation and radiation is so different that it's not even an apple and an orange. You're comparing an elephant to a pencil, if you know what I mean. It's that kind of difference. So therefore, had we been smart enough to call it radio signaling, radio transmission, or any other combination of words, we wouldn't be having this problem. So what you're going to read, a lot of people are reporting to me that the National Institute of Health and the Long Island Brookhaven National Laboratory have been running a series of experiments. A neuroscientist named Nora Volkow, V-O-L-K-O-W, submitted 47 Long Island volunteers to holding a cell phone on the left ear and a cell phone on the right ear. And it was a kind of a double-blind test. One of the cell phones was going to be turned on, and one of them was not. And as such, while these people were being subjected to a PET scan, positron emission tomography, in other words, for diagnostic reasons, they were about to be subjected to a PET scan. While the PET scan was taking place, these volunteers volunteered to simultaneously do it with a cell phone, and they found out what took place. It is well known that every cell phone, when you've got it plastered up against your ear and it's a quarter inch away from your head, is creating some RF emitted energy. That
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When that RF transmitted energy hits the protoplasm of your body, the water content of your body, that RF energy is turned into heat, the so-called thermal effect. 60 years of research have found out that 99.99% of the effect of a radio wave is a thermal effect. For all of those years, they've been looking for the non-thermal effect. People want to believe that the radio wave is going to excite the nerves and do something bad, change the mitosis of the cells and do something bad, the dividing cells, you're going to get cancer and whatever. People want to believe that. There is no confirmed measurement that says that that is true. Lots of people have been looking for it. They can't find it. There's a high probability it doesn't exist. As such, it's only a thermal effect. The United States standard is the amount of thermal effect you're allowed to have from a radio signal coming from something like a cell phone or a handy talkie or anything else that you put near your body or near your head in particular. Let me drop. You're allowed to have a certain number of milliwatts per square centimeter. That's one way of making the measurement. Another way of making the measurement is 1.6 watts per kilogram of SAR. SAR stands for specific absorption rate. So as the thermal energy, as the RF energy comes out of that antenna in your cell phone, and most of it goes out into the air and talks to the cell site that's nearby you, but a certain amount of it goes into the direction toward your head. There is no stopping that from happening. You may think you're going to buy this fancy little paste-on piece of copper with an exotic shape to it. You paid a whole lot of dollars for it, and it's going to give you a shield, and you're going to stop the radio energy from coming out of your cell phone in the direction of your head. You may believe that if you like. It's snake oil. Because the wavelengths are so big and the antenna is so small, it is an isotropic radiator. It is radiating a signal in all directions with no preferential direction. So half of all that, three-quarters of that energy goes out into space, one-quarter of it goes in the direction of your head, and as it goes into your head, the only thing it does is creates thermal heating. And as long as the thermal heating is below 1.6 watts per kilogram, assessed to the nearest gram of material, it is considered safe by the American standard. The Brits, who we think have a more conservative number, use 2 watts per kilogram, more than our 1.6. Are they really conservative? You can ask that question. Let me drop. I don't know the exact number, but the 1.6 watts per kilogram of thermal effect from the radio energy you're allowed to have with the cell phones that can be sold in the United States and many other countries in the world creates some amount of heating, and maybe that amount of heating is half a degree centigrade or half a degree Fahrenheit. 1.6 watts per kilogram. When you lay on the sun in the summertime and the sun is shining on you, you're getting something like 10 watts per kilogram. You're allowed 1.6 from the cell phone. And by the way, the 10 watts per kilogram you're getting from the sun is whole body exposure. And your body can easily handle that. So the 1.6 watts per kilogram into that cranial material, which has a prodigious flow of blood, it's got a very natural cooling system. The total amount of heating is some small fraction of a degree Fahrenheit or centigrade. I don't know the exact number. The only confirmed measurement that has ever been made that I know of is that they had a number of people with a cell phone hold the cell phone against the head while doing mental mathematics. And they found out the people with the operating cell phone, which had the local heating of that portion of the brain material, those people could do mental mathematics slightly faster and slightly more accurate. In other words, you heat up your brain material by, let me pick a number, half a degree Fahrenheit. It calculates better. It calculates faster. You come up with a mathematical answer using mental mathematics that's better. That doesn't sound detrimental. So what they discovered with these cell phones that were operating for 50 solid minutes during these PET scans is that the thermal heating, which is probably less than 1.6 watts per kilogram, that thermal heating, when measured with a PET scan, determined that extra metabolism was taking place. In other words, the glucose metabolism of the brain in that area went up.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I said glucose tolerance. The glucose metabolism for that portion of the brain that was being heated by the cell phone went up 7%. So 1.07 was the new ratio of glucose tolerance for that portion of the brain that was being heated by the cell phone. Your next question is that detrimental? I know for a fact that what will happen is you'll calculate mental mathematics slightly more rapidly. That's what the 7/10 of an increase of glucose is doing. The brain is operating a little bit faster because it's running slightly warmer. When you and I get a fever, our temperature can go up to, let me pick a number, 104 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a 4 or 5 degrees of increase of total body temperature while you're running a fever. And is that permanently detrimental? Probably not. But if you get a fraction of a degree Fahrenheit increase because of a cell phone, is that going to do you damage? I won't say absolutely positively no, but the chances of it, in my mind, are very, very slim. But now, you got to get back to what is risk assessment. It's a really tough one for the general American public. They have, you can tell by many articles that have been in Science Magazine, the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, have on a number of occasions had articles as to how well or how poorly the American population and maybe the world population assesses risk. Everything we do has risk. 40,000 Americans per year die in an automobile accident. Every one of us, when we climb into that car in the morning to drive ourselves to work, we say, it's not going to happen to me. I'm going to drive carefully. I'm going to wear my seatbelt. I've taken a defensive driving course. I know some of the protection procedures. I think I'm safe. I'm not going to drive while I'm intoxicated and whatever. You're going to do a bunch of things so that you're not one of those 40,000. We all accept that. 90,000 to 140,000 Americans per year die because of their excess consumption of sodium in their diet. That's documented by the Journal of American Medical Association, 2010, and a similar article appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. 90,000 to 140,000 excess coronary deaths because of sodium. So there's risk in everything we do. The salt that is in your food is killing you. The automobiles are killing you. But we all say it's not going to happen to us. There is nothing you can do that has zero risk. The only thing left to discuss is what is the risk-to-benefit ratio. I know that that cell phone saves a hell of a lot of lives. It gives us a lot of convenience. It gives us a lot of benefit. Is there absolutely positively zero risk from using the cell phone? If I was in a court of law and I was asked that question that directly, and if I was considered an expert in that subject, I could not give a perfectly honest affirmative answer that there's zero risk. Is the amount of risk acceptable? I say, yea, verily. But I'm not the only person who feels that way. There are some people, and if you go to that particular website for the Village of Bayville, you go to the website that's entitled www.BRACT. That stands for Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. You go to that particular website, very well confirmed, very professional looking.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
A very professional looking website. Unfortunately, every single article that has ever been printed anywhere on planet Earth that is adverse to cell phone usage is in that website. No other side of the article, argument is presented. Only all of the negative issues, because the residents of that town, in all honesty, have come to conclude that radiation, that radio signals are dangerous, and all antennas must be removed from their town. That means cell site antennas, fire antennas, ambulance antennas, police antennas. Every antenna must be removed from the town. That is their desire. I don't believe that's a worthwhile goal, but I know people in that town, they are sincere. They think they're doing the right thing to protect their children. And we amateurs who understand radio are going to have to very, very slowly. It's going to be a long time. It's going to take generations. We have to re-educate that community because they're making a decision that is impossible to do. They're going to be wasting a lot of anguish and money and time, and they can't possibly get the success they're looking for. If you're absolutely positive, I used to think that if you wanted to really be away from all radio signals, let me drop. I used to think you'd have to live with the Amish or the Mennonites in Pennsylvania. That's the only way you can really get away from all electronic components in the 21st century. Even that's not true anymore, because the smart Amish people have realized that even though they're not using it, they can get some cash flow out of their farmland by renting spaces to cell site towers. So the cell sites are even in the Amish communities. So There is no getting away with it. You have to live on a desert island to really get away from radio. So you're going to be, your friends who know that you're a radio enthusiast are going to be telling you about this article in Newsday, and it's appeared in a bunch of other journals. And sometimes some of the articles are written in a very sensationalistic manner. We're all being blasted. Let's see, the Newsday article says, what's the title on it here? Heads up on cell phones. And so it's not quite as sensationalistically written in Newsday, but in other journals they're leading you to believe that we're going down the tubes with cancer because of cell phones. And now there's a related issue about this one I'm going to tell you right now. But before we leave this one, anybody, any quick questions or comments on this article about the 7% increase of the glucose metabolism of a human brain when a cell phone operating for 50 solid minutes is held alongside of that head? KQLIW and the TechNet listening.
KC2ER. I had a question and a comment on this. I don't know if I will skip on my question, but I comment on radiation. When you talk about radiation, how about transmission of electricity on high voltage? For many years, people have suffered from that and did nothing. All of a sudden now, we're worried about cell phones, radiation. Don't talk about radiation of our high current in our neighborhoods.
Angel, I recommend you speak a little bit softer. You're banging up against the side of the repeater. Your microphone is very hot. We called you twice at approximately 10 minutes to 9 when your number came up, so to speak. And then I came back a little later and called you again, and you weren't available. So we tried to talk to you, and I know you probably got called away, and unfortunately the timing wasn't quite right. When it comes to the power distribution systems that are used in the United States, the high voltage lines, sometimes as many as 360,000 volts, and if those high tension lines on 150-foot high towers go across your particular farmland, for instance, have people suffered from that damage? Again, the American National Standard Institute, the so-called C95 report, rates that danger as to how many volts per meter, how many amps per meter, how much magnetic field or how much electric field a human being is allowed to continuously be exposed to. And I can tell you that those high-tension lines do not exceed those limits. There are various people who think that they've been suffering health effects from those high-tension lines. There are farmers who think their cows are not giving as much milk, and their chickens are not giving as many eggs, and the potatoes are not growing as well because of those high-tension lines. There are people who believe that. There is no confirmation to date of that. Lots of measurements have been made in laboratories as to whether or not a dividing cell gets injured by those kind of electric signals. Let me drop for a second. Whenever you have a significant-looking piece of hardware that's not understood, a cell site is a very significant-looking piece of hardware. Whenever you've got these high-tension towers with 350 kilovolt lines going across them, very significant piece of hardware, people get the impression that they don't understand it and it could represent a danger. You've heard the story that when they first put electrification into the National Capitol, the White House, when they first put electric lights in the White House, the people who turned on and off the switches to turn the lights on and off in the morning and the nighttime, in the beginning, those people got hazardous duty pay because they were doing high-risk environment, because people used to believe that the electrical signal lighting those light bulbs was going to be pouring out of the electrical socket. People used to believe that an empty electrical socket on the wall, electrons would be pouring out of there, and they would be spraying out of there into your body and doing things similar to what happens inside of a light bulb. People used to believe that. So there's a lot of belief of things like this, but if you do the right kind of research, if you look at the right articles, if you read the right reports on this subject, this is not something brand new. It's been around for a long time. It's been investigated, and the chances of it being a health hazard, I wouldn't say it's zero, but I think it's very, very low, Angel. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, from the Bronx. I'll have some fun with you, Angel. KQLIW on the TechNet.
Thank you very much. No, I seem like I had ate something and I must have passed out. But if I could throw my question out there, it was related to grounds and mobile rigs on the vehicle.
Yeah, go ahead with your question because you did sign in earlier and we tried to get to you. Angel, you got to speak a little softer or you got to set that mic gain a little bit lower. You're extremely loud. Over to you, Angel.
Okay, my question is on, I just got the 706 and I'm just putting my HF antenna. I got to set some grounds. What is a good ground and how do you, where would be the best ground to put at and where do you use the, I've seen people use grounded on the, in the engine. Where would be the best spot to get a good ground from a vehicle?
I'm not sure that everyone will agree on this, but I'm going to give you my opinion on this, and I'm also going to pass it over to Mel because he's done a lot of mobile installations. In my opinion, the very best kind of a installation in an automobile, particularly if it's a transmitter running more than, let's say, 10 watts, would be for there a heavy gauge piece of wire, like an 8-gauge piece of wire, going from the rig, and I'm talking about the red lead for the positive and the black lead for the negative, two separate twisted pair 8-gauge wires, for instance, going directly from the rig through the firewall of the car, connecting right back to the battery. In other words, if your rig is getting its grounding and its power on both the positive lead and the negative lead, with fuses on each of those wires at the battery, but if it's getting it directly from the battery, it is my belief you'll have the least amount of risk of the electrical equipment of the car, the internal computer, the dashboard indications, all of that giving you any grief. That's the best kind of wiring, in my opinion. Let me drop. There are a number of people who skimped on that wiring, where they'll run one single positive lead from the battery positive terminal to the radio, and then because they're saving money and time and whatever, they'll take the grounded lead of the radio and just connect it to the chassis in some convenient place near the radio. I do not recommend you do that. You do that, you're setting up some wild currents in funny places in the car that was never part of the original design. In my opinion, there's a significantly higher probability you're going to interfere with the emission control computer, the dashboard indications, whatever. There are cases like that where a guy will key the transmitter and the engine speeds up, or the engine stalls, or the dashboard goes crazy. In my opinion, the best wiring is both of those leads from the radio, thoroughly insulated. Make sure it doesn't have the ability to be cut by the sheet metal at the firewall. Make sure there's the proper kind of grommet and whatever. But that wiring going right straight back to the battery, I think, is the best way to do it. Mel's done a lot of installations. So have the guys at the Kings County Radio Club. Let's see how they've done it. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Exactly. Well, exactly the way I've done it. The only thing that I will add to that is put a fuse both in the positive and the negative lead right at the battery. That's what I have. It's fused so that, as you say, going through the firewall and all, if something just happens to, you know, create a way that it cuts into that wire, you don't want to have direct connection to that battery without a fuse protection. Also, I bonded bonded the negative lead. Also, I put straps down to the regular chassis, into the body, and everything like that. Found that I think it reduced some of the noise situations by grounding the exhaust system to the chassis then and all. It seems to run a little quieter, you know, mobiling. I think it is, but, you know, that could be debatable. But the point is, as far as the electrical circuit, that Vic said, like running the number 10 wires through the firewall, right at the battery, putting a fuse both in both leads, and that is the best way to assure good mobile operation, Vic, as far as the electrical system. Over.
Yeah, glad to hear that, Mel. And when you wire it that way, Angel, you'll get the least amount of generator whine. You'll get the most amount of performance out of your radio. You get the least amount